Yes, we are welcoming a new show to iHeart and the DraftKings YouTube channel. It's called Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano. John Wall doesn't need no introduction. It's an insider's look at the NBA and culture surrounding the league. Every week, the five-time All-Star and the number one pick of the 2010 NBA Draft, John Wall, will give his unique perspective on the hottest topics in the league. So check out Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano on the iHeartRadio app, the DraftKings YouTube channel, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.
Refinancing your car at Kemba Financial Credit Union can get you quick access to cash to help manage high-rate debts and expenses. Get up to $500 next day cash back, plus no payments for 90 days, and take cash equity out. Make your car work for you and drive away with extra cash. Apply at Kemba.org. Restrictions apply. Offer ends April 30th, 2024. Federally insured by NCUA.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. Whether it's a walk-off grand slam or a base hit to center field. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment. It's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER.
The I Am Rappaport Stereo Podcast. Live.
You down with Rappaport? Yes, I am. You down with Rappaport? Yes, I am. You down with Rappaport? Yes, I am. You down with Rappaport? Yes, I am.
You better tune in, IamRappaport.com. Cause every single podcast, you know he drops bombs. I seen him on set, a seasoned vet with true talent. Catch him on his way to CrossFit, rocking the New Balance. He asked me to do the track cause he know I rhyme elite. But I'm just waiting for the Robert De Niro line of the week. Breakfast of Champions, toasted bagel, cream cheese, and lox. This is I Am Rappaport, the show never stops. You might catch him out in public, stretching his knees. But if you don't listen to the show, yo, wigga please.
Wigga please.
This is the Podcast.
All right, this is the I Am Rappaport Stereo Podcast. Some are calling this the Signature Series, the Interview Series. We're live from the Gloom Tomb in Los Angeles, California. I'm in here with my guest co-host for this interview. It's the first time he's joining me on an interview, so the first time I'm sort of taking him out in public. Dean Collins.
What's up?
Interviewing the iconic, influential, very influential Tom Green today.
Hell yeah. That's exciting for me.
All right. Why is it exciting for you? So those of you who don't know Tom Green, Dean, why don't you break down Tom Green?
Tom Green, he comes from the 90s.
MTV.
MTV, he had the Tom Green Show.
Which is enormously influential.
Like, my bum is on you, the wall. My bum is on the...
And the Tom Green Show, he one of the things that he did that... I mean, he was one of the first sort of shock, real, you know, sort of mixing sort of, is this reality? Is this a stunt?
And just weird. Like, he had his own thing.
He was sort of doing the Zach Galifianakis shit before Zach Galifianakis.
Exactly. I mean, Road Trip.
Road Trip. Freddie Got Fingered. The whole Drew Barrymore thing.
Oh, yeah. His
whole thing. I mean, he was doing the damn thing for a long time, and he's been just sort of ahead of a curve with technology. Like, he had a web show way before motherfucker. Now, like, everybody's got a web show.
But you were on his web show.
I was on his web show in his house, like in 2007.
Yeah.
You know, and it was like, what the fuck? You know, he's always sort of been a little bit ahead of the curve.
He had a little hiccup, too, with I think he had testicular
cancer. Yeah, he had testicular cancer, and he documented the whole thing, and it was a whole docuseries. And so we're going to be interviewing him. I don't know, Dean, here's what I'm going to recommend. You're going to have questions. You're going to get excited. You're going to get excited. You're going to ask.
Not.
Yeah, you are. But what I want you to do is ask clean and concise questions.
Okay.
So pretend I'm Tom Green and ask a question. We're going to do a test question right now.
Okay. What was it like being on the set of Road Trip?
That's the fucking question. That's the question you're going to ask.
That's
Tom?
Not what I'm going to ask him. You just said give you an example
All
question.
Right. I want you to, before he gets here,
have a list.
Have your list and get your fucking mind right.
That's great.
This is the Iron Rapport Stereo Podcast. We're going to be coming right back. The I Am Rapaport Podcast is sponsored by Casper Mattresses, Casper.com. It's an award-winning sleep startup. Go to Casper.com, $50 off purchase of any size mattress. Put in the code Rappaport, R-A-P-A-P-O-R-T, Casper Mattress in New York City. You can keep the bed for 100 nights. You can get your freak on for 100 nights. If you do not like the bed after 100 nights, you can return the mattress within 100 days. That's a guarantee. The bed will be delivered between 2 to 5 days anywhere in the United States and Canada. Same day delivery in New York City. We do not plug, we do not support, we do not take sponsorship from anything we have not tried and we are not passionate about 450%. So I'm in here with Tom Green.
Yeah.
People think that Dean's my son. He's not.
Hello.
Yeah. Hello.
He's my guest co-host.
Okay. Your son.
Not my son. And not the actual co-host. The actual co-host is a guy named G Monetti.
Yeah.
AKA the Black Ed McMahon.
Uh-huh.
But he's in the Bronx.
Yeah.
And Dean is a big fan.
You're
of
the
yours.
Albino Rhino.
I'm the Albino Rhino. Yeah. Some call me the Gringo Mandingo.
Yeah.
I have a lot of aliases. They just keep coming. And we're in here with Tom Green, who. Shit, man. We were talking about like how, I mean, you have to know this, and I'm going to pry it at you because I think as performers, we all have a certain amount of ego. But I was thinking about how, like, when you first came on the scene, how influential what you did was and continues to be.
Uh-huh.
We were even, me and Dean, the guest co-host.
Yeah, hi.
Hi, how are
we're
you?
We're saying you were doing, and it's no disrespect and all this shit, but like we were kind of saying that. We're outside, by the way.
Yeah, it's nice.
We're at the
airport. That's the paparazzi because
right
they knew we had Tom Green.
Yeah. It's LAPD, actually.
Yeah, that's security and paparazzi. But so don't mind that because normally we do it inside. But like, I mean, in not in any disrespect because I love him too. But like, you were kind of like doing what Zach Galifianakis is even doing. Like you brought like a, for me like. When I did your web series at home, your web show at home at your house, I was like when I was on the way up there, I remember feeling like, what's going to happen with this guy? Like, am I going to get into a fight? Is he going to be combative? Like, I remember feeling like a little bit like you had motherfuckers on edge,
uh-huh.
and I think and I say that in a good way. Like, I just didn't know like what to expect, and when you did that, I mean, I'm sure you probably say you have your influences, and I would love to hear them. But like when you first came on the scene, it was outrageous, but in a good way. And it was shocking in a good way. And there was this sort of line, is it real? Is it not real?
Mm-hmm.
Similar to like the Galifianakis and even like Will Ferrell to a certain extent, like his acting. But you were treading the line. Like, are you aware of that now? Like the influence? And I'm sure people
love those guys. And, I've gotten to meet Zach Galifianakis, he's super cool. Will, I did first time I was ever in a movie. I was in a movie with Will Ferrell. It was a superstar movie, but I mean, we were always trying to do more. I mean, back then, especially, it was all about the video camera, right? It was about real people. It wasn't so much acting as Will and Zach are, great comedic actors. This was more about pranks and pulling stunts and. Getting real reactions from real people on the street back in those, certainly in those early times, when we started the show on cable TV in Canada.
It was originally cable in Canada.
Yeah, public access TV in Canada. So I was a skateboarder, I was into hip hop music.
Right.
I was into counterculture stuff back then, right?
What part of Canada?
It was counterculture back then. Now it's mainstream now, I guess.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
Isn't that fucking nuts that hip hop is like...
Yeah, hip hop and skateboarding and everything that, you know, we liked when we were kids is now the biggest thing in media, pretty much. But yeah, I mean, we were trying to do something different. We knew there was no YouTube, there was none of that stuff.
There wasn't the instant.
Yeah.
And you came on the scene before the Jackass guys came on, you know, like the Tom Green show. That was revolutionary. Yeah, Seeing that for the first time was like, there was nothing like it.
Yeah, when MTV picked up the show, it was kind of a surreal experience because, you know, we'd been doing it on public access TV, right, in Canada. We didn't even get MTV in Canada.
Oh, shit.
So now all of a sudden we were on MTV. We knew what MTV was, right? Like, we'd heard the Dire Straits song.
Right. You know,
we knew what it was. We had Much Music in Canada. But this... Much Music didn't really have TV shows.
Was Much Music like a...
It was like music videos all day. Now all of a sudden we were on MTV and they were playing the show, you know.
What part of Canada are you from?
Ottawa. Ottawa, yeah. Ottawa.
Means nothing to me except for
Canada. It's the capital of Canada.
Yeah, I know. And the Ottawa, what's
Did you know that?
No, I didn't know
Nobody
that.
Nobody knows that.
I didn't know that. I didn't know that, Tom. My brother lives in Halifax.
Yeah, okay.
My brother's a professor.
Yeah, nice.
At the University of Halifax there. Yeah. And the Ottawa has the Winnipegs. No, the Winnipegs.
The Senators.
Ottawa Senators.
Winnipeg is a city in Manitoba. And they've got the Jets.
The Winnipeg Jets, the Montreal Canadiens, the Toronto
Montreal
Maple
Canadiens,
Leafs.
Toronto Maple Leafs, yeah. Ottawa Senators, yeah.
Vancouver Canucks,
yeah.
I know a little bit about.
Yeah.
Edmonton Oilers,
yeah. Wayne Gretzky dynasty back in the 80s, yeah.
Right. Mark Messier,
absolutely.
Wayne Gretzky.
Mark Messier.
And
Yari Curry, Paul Coffey.
Yeah. Dynasty.
They were the Chicago Bulls of hockey.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, of course, because Wayne Gretzky, the great one.
Yeah, absolutely. It was incredible. It was an incredible time for hockey. That's when I was most into hockey, was when the Oilers were experiencing their dynasty years.
I would love to continue the hockey conversation with you, but that's as far as my knowledge goes, as far as Canadian hockey. I could talk some New York Rangers shit in the 70s, but I feel like that would alienate my audience even further.
That's okay.
All right, but anyway, so back to you and your stuff. So when did it go like, this is sort of becoming a thing, the Tom Green show?
From public access to MTV.
Like, when it hit on MTV, like, when did it, like, was it instant?
In our minds, we were going to try to make this show something big, even from when we first started it. When I say our minds, my friends and I. I worked on the show with a bunch of my friends.
Right.
I was a broadcasting student. We made videos. We convinced the public access station to give us a time slot. You know, this was an everyday, day in, get up in the morning, edit till 4 o'clock in the morning, every single day, 7 days a week. Passion, dream thing for me, right? I was living in my parents' basement. But we got, like, the local paper did an article about the show early on. Full-page article in the Ottawa Citizen.
Uh-huh.
That was very inspiring. I was able to show my parents that. I was like, see, look, they did an article in the paper. I'm not wasting my time.
Right.
And so we did it for about another 5 years, and we shot, like, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of videos.
Right.
And eventually I had the opportunity to send them to MTV through somebody that I'd met. And, give you the short version of the story. They picked up the show and moved us to New York, and the show went on the air. And it was pretty much an instant hit show on MTV.
It was instant.
Instant. I remember that before they even started airing the show, MTV used to run promos all the time. So they'd run the promos as much as they ran the show. So the promos started running 2 weeks before the show. And I remember when we moved to New York, the show hadn't even started airing yet, and everybody in the streets were, you know, hey, you're that guy that was humping that dead moose, you know?
Right.
So it was pretty cool.
Because MTV was, at the time, that was the place to be.
Yeah,
like, now it's sort of a fucking joke.
I think it's an interesting thing. Like, I don't think television will ever really even be the same as it was back then, you know.
Right, no
MTV
way.
MTV was completely different. Television in general is completely different. You know, I don't think there's a lot of places where you could put a TV show on right now and experience the kind of instant sort of notoriety that show got.
Yeah.
But did you go about it differently when it went from public access to MTV? obviously, like, it was still your thing, and it was shocking and outrageous and funny, but...
Remember when I said to you, I said, if you're going to ask this fucking guy questions, like, get to the fucking point,
what do you mean? I'm asking him a question.
But it's a fucking paragraph. Like, get to the fucking point.
What's a question?
Point.
What do you... It can't have, like, three words, and then that's it.
But I said, just... I said beforehand, I said, if you're going to ask him a fucking question...
You did say that.
Yeah.
Okay, but he was
because he's
that
he's looking like he's fucking bored to tears.
Shit. No, okay, no, no. Well, no, I'm enjoying this. It's okay. Fun watching you guys.
No, go ahead.
Cool.
Go ahead.
Argue
dude.
With each other.
You. Get the fucking
well,
question
you just
out.
Took my flow out. Now,
all right, go
so.
Ahead. I can't remember where you were.
Did you
going.
Go about
you're sure
it?
Sure, this is not your son.
It's not my fucking.
You're
son.
Sure?
I promise it's not.
Are you 100% sure?
I'm 100%. He played okay. My son on a show
okay. 10 years ago,
and the show got canceled, and
he has paid me to be his best friend ever since. I promise you.
All right, go ahead.
Anyway, did you go about it differently when it went to MTV at all?
Like, were there parameters on MTV?
There were parameters, but we tried to sort of circumvent those parameters. Right. There was a conflict. There was a period of time where we were being told what we were not supposed to do, and I didn't enjoy that. And I was very passionate about the show and what it was supposed to be. You know, I fought for my ideas. I had some pushback from the network, but they kind of let me fight for my ideas too. They didn't just shut me down.
And, was it content or like? Because you're not a cursor. I don't. You're not like I curse.
Yeah.
My depths of the English language, they're not long.
Yeah.
And I lean on the curse.
Uh-huh.
But was it scary? Was it cursing? Like what were the sort of like the things
it
you
was,
were fighting about?
It was honestly. It was just. I had written and edited the entire show, pretty much everything. I had a couple of friends that helped me, but I had edited everything. I'd pretty much been the creative director of the show, I mm-hmm. guess you'd say, for now, you know, 7 or 8 years at this point we'd been doing it. Now, when we moved to New York, all of a sudden they gave us like 6 writers.
Oh.
You know? And so
they brought them into
they would present
you.
All these ideas to me, and I would, you know, of course had a right to approve them. But then when I didn't approve ideas, you know, executive would come in from the network and say, no, I really want you to do this idea. Mm. And I'd have to say, no, that's not funny to me. I mean, it might be funny to you, but it's not funny to me. And that's not really what the show is. So that was one argument, having to sort of explain why I didn't want to do their ideas that they had paid writers to write.
Right.
Okay.
And these were writers that these weren't your this wasn't your crew. These were
not
just
my
writers.
Crew. I had my crew there of one guy who was a friend of mine who came down, but it was mostly their crew.
Right.
And so I had to kind of explain no, and I would go in the room with the writers and I would help teach these writers how we shot our bits mm-hmm. and how it involved getting reactions from people and how we had to try to incorporate people on the street into the
right.
comedy as opposed to it just being a sketch and things like this. Right.
Right.
And, you know, they were more familiar with writing scripts and scripted stuff. And we were more, you know, trying to say, no, no, this is about, you know, candid camera. This is about pranks. This is about interacting with the real world, getting reactions. Then the other thing is they had all our videos that we'd already shot, and then they would re-edit them and take all the funny stuff out.
Oh.
They specifically wanted to take, and when I say they, it was just a couple of executives at MTV.
That's
who
all you need.
You know, they aren't there anymore, and they were great
Where
people.
Where are they now?
And I'm not sure, but the thing is they did, I don't really like to, I don't want to badmouth them in any way because
I'll
at the end
it.
Of the day, they, no, well, at the end of the day, they're also the same people that picked up the show.
Okay.
Right? So they didn't have to do that, right? Like, they saw the show, they liked it enough to pick it up, and it was a life-changing decision for me, that them making that decision to pick it up. So it really changed my life entirely.
Okay.
And so it was a good thing. But then, you know, then everyone likes to get creative and
right.
put their ideas in. There was a policy at MTV that they didn't want anybody on the air appearing on camera who was over the age of 35. And so in our show, we would go out in the street and do all these pranks. I'd go out in crutches and fall on the ground and watch people try to help me and stuff, and the a lot of the times it was funny when like old people got yeah. freaked out, right?
And they didn't want them.
They went the videos and they took all the reaction shots of all the old people freaking out, and
as if old people didn't exist in the zeitgeist.
Yeah, but it was also like that was the joke, right?
Why? But
we're
why?
Confusing
why
old
that?
People
because they're fucking executives, and you know, I mean,
but then like then and then
they
Jackass
had a blanket
comes about.
Policy. It's MTV. It's a youth channel. We never have anybody on camera who's over the age of 35.
You die at 35.
Yeah.
After 35,
unless
dead.
It's Kurt Loder, You're dead. Yeah.
Rest of the planet is just 35 and under. Man.
So it took sort of a fair amount of explaining and negotiating and arguing and screaming and yelling and calling managers. I had a manager at this point. Uh-huh. I'd call the manager. The manager would call them. They'd argue, and then they'd call and argue with me. But eventually they put the clips back in, and people started to kind of see what it was that we were doing. It was really like those early year of the show that we were on MTV. It was really me kind of like sort of I guess I was sort of telling them how to do the show. They didn't know how to do this kind of show.
I got you.
They didn't know how to do a show where you go out in the street with a camera and like goof around, you know. It was the first time we went out to do a sort of a prank on the street.
Yeah. What was it?
It was we went to New Jersey. We went to Princeton, New Jersey. It was the first time I ever shot a piece in America with an MTV crew. Up to then, we were just airing our old clips. So we went over to Princeton, New Jersey to film this bit. It was called Camouflage. I wore camouflage clothing, and I was hiding in shrubbery.
Uh-huh.
And when people would walk by, I would jump out of the shrubbery and say, "You can't see me because I'm camouflaged." Right? But that was the bit we decided to do that day. That's what we decided to do with our time that day. So we got to the shoot, and I was just amazed. They sent like about 25 producers walking down the street with clipboards with release forms, going up to people on the sidewalk before I jumped out of the shrubbery. And asking them, "Hey, can you sign a release form? Someone's going to jump out of the shrubbery up here, and we want you to act surprised." And so I sort of had to sort of take all of these 25 producers aside, and these producers are like, guys my age, in their 20s,
right?
And I just, this is not how you do it. And then this is their first job,
right?
So now they're all worried that they're going to get in trouble because that's what their boss told them to do,
right?
So now there's a big argument. So now we're all sulking in the van on the way back to Manhattan, right? And we get back, and I say, "Well, we can't shoot it like that. We had to have a big meeting. Everybody was all worried." But then eventually they started to understand what it was that I was trying to do. And, I think they got it eventually because they ended up making about 20 more shows that were exactly the same. So
it was so popular. I feel like if they tried to reel you in, you had the leverage to be like, "Look, I'm not doing this. I'm going to fucking
walk." Most of these arguments and things happened in the first month.
Right.
And then that's what happened.
Then
really.
They got it, though.
Like, the show came out. The show was successful. It was that show Talk Soup was ours.
Yeah, right. Damn.
So they would have these huge arguments with me about a bit. They say, "You can't air this bit." And I would get really adamant. "We have to air this bit."
How old are you at this time?
I was 28.
28, okay. Yeah.
So I was old enough
Were you nervous arguing with them? Because I still find to this day, when you're taking on the quote-unquote man, it's like, "Oh, if I take on the man, I'm going to be deemed difficult. I'm going to,
Yeah, I think I was sort of naive in the sense that I didn't think that people would look at it as being difficult. I thought they would look at it as me being passionate about my art.
Right.
And, I didn't grow up in Los Angeles. I had never, been in any sort of, movie or TV show.
Right.
At 28 years old, I was never really in show business in any sense.
Right.
I had no concept of how it worked. All it was for me was, this is my show that I've made. I've been working on it for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
I am very passionate about what it's supposed to be like,
mm-hmm.
and I'm going to make it like this, and I was willing to kind of fight for it, and, I think probably, it's tough to say, like, hindsight's 20/20. If I was to go back, I might not have fought as hard, and then maybe the show wouldn't have been as ridiculous as it was, so I wouldn't take it back, but I think I learned a lot over the last, over the last 15 years in L.A. that you can't just go in and, It's too bad that, television's a collaborative thing, right? It's not about, giving somebody an opportunity to go out and just do whatever they fucking want.
Right. Right.
Which is what I wanted that show to be, and that's sort of what that show was. And,
right.
That's how it came across.
And it's not really, I'm not really like that anymore. I think it's the reason why I do stand-up and why I do my podcast. Because I don't have anybody telling me what to do, and I can go do what I want. And then if I go do a film or a TV show, which I occasionally go do those things still, I'm happy to sit back and take direction and, be a team player and all that stuff. It's something that's a different thing. But at that period of time in my life, it was about, you know, protecting the integrity of this show. There was no other show like it on TV.
Right.
So I
what felt, were your influences?
I felt like we were kind of trying to create or invent something, you know?
Were you aware that you were, I threw a question at you, but were you aware that, like, were you conscious, I'm trying to create this sort of genre of...
Yeah.
Comedy, this sort of genre of you were that was sort of in your head.
Yeah, it was written up. We had like write-ups. Like I had like a treatment of the show that explained exactly what we were trying to do, how it was different, you know, how it was incorporating real people into sketches, how, you know, the reaction shot was the punchline,
right?
Teaching our camera guys how to make sure that when, you know, I'm out in the street doing something crazy, don't film me. You know, film the person that's watching me, because we can always film me later.
Right.
You can't get that shot back of the person watching me, you know? It was always like this, quote from John Cleese. He said, you know, it's funny to watch somebody acting silly, but it's even funnier to watch somebody watching someone act silly.
Right.
So that was sort of the mantra for the show.
Okay.
Was just kind of go out, create a scene, get a reaction, film the reaction.
Okay.
And so that was a big thing that when we started the show too, you know, at MTV, was we'd go out with our camera and I, you know, the bit would be, I'm a security guard, right? I'm walking around in a mall crashing into stuff, you know? Mm-hmm. And we'd come back and look at the footage and they just filmed me, you
right.
know? And there wasn't the people in the background who
right.
were like freaking out. They didn't get the shot. So, but we eventually kind of got everyone doing what we got a good crew together. It was really cool. Those were the glory days.
MTV is such a pile of shit now.
It really is a fucking shit show. Music is a shit show in general. Like the music industry,
the content. It's like, from the Tom Green show, so many other people, like, it spawned Andy Milonakis and Jackass and all those guys. Like, I feel like
MTV
owes so much to you, especially.
But those guys aren't on TV anymore either. So
no, they're not.
Like,
but
like
no, they shut the whole thing down.
They shut the whole thing down. But you were the first one to really do that.
I'm not sure. I think we're kind of in a weird time for television in general, right?
Mm-hmm. It's a good time in some ways.
Yeah. There's a lot of it.
Yeah, there's a lot.
A lot of television. There's a lot of channels.
There's a lot.
There's a lot of networks.
But I think it's probably
hard to break through and actually get that kind of, you know, audience that it was back when there was fewer channels.
Yeah. I agree.
Which is sort of, it's a good thing for people who are actors and people that want to make television because there's so many shows getting made. But it's never, I don't think if you put a show on MTV now, you wouldn't have 3 million people watching the show. The first month it's on the air, and that just doesn't seem to happen that much anymore. So,
and I hope that television doesn't blow itself up, because there is so many fucking channels. I mean, there's so many channels, there's so many networks, and there's so many good things. But there's just, I feel like it's like every day there's this channel, there's that channel, there's Apple TV, there's channels within Apple TV, there's YouTube channels.
They're still figuring it out, but
I just hope it doesn't. You know, like, it doesn't, like, the bubble doesn't burst.
Yeah.
How was the transition from going from the Tom Green show to doing movies? Was it more nerve-wracking knowing that it was like, okay, I have these set of lines, like, you know, I could improv, do my thing, but what was that like?
It was pretty cool. I mean, some parts of it were nerve-wracking, although I get nervous about virtually everything, pretty much, you know.
Like, are you nervous right now?
I mean, a little bit.
You shouldn't be.
This is a good atmosphere.
I mean, I'm not that nervous now, because I'm very comfortable in this environment, you know, podcasting.
Right,
stuff.
Yeah. Right.
But like when I'm going on a show, like a talk show where there's an audience.
Yeah.
Usually when there's an audience involved.
There's that rush.
I get that adrenaline rush. I get those nerves. Back then it was... maybe a little more nerve-wracking because I'd never done any scripted things before. The first movie was Road Trip that I did, and that was kind of basically the first time I was in a movie. I was in this movie Superstar with Will Ferrell before that, just cut a couple of lines. My friend, one of the kids in the hall, was directing it, Bruce McCullough.
Right.
And he had been watching my cable show and put me in that movie before MTV. That was sort of the first sort of real show business experience I had. We shot that movie up in Toronto. But... I think I had two lines in the movie, so I didn't really have to worry about memorizing lines or anything. But Todd Phillips directed Road Trip, and he was a fan of the Tom Green Show, and he put me in these Pepsi One commercials that ran during the NCAA basketball tournament, March Madness, during the first season of MTV, during the first few months of the MTV show. And that's kind of how I met Todd, and then I ended up doing that Road Trip movie, and that was fun. I wasn't supposed to stick the mouse in my mouth.
That's what I was going
to
ask.
In the script, I'm supposed to feed the mouse to the snake, but then I put the mouse in my mouth.
When the camera's rolling?
Yeah, when the camera's rolling.
It's fucking...
I was dangling the mouse above my mouth, and I felt it sort of grab my lip with its little paw, so I just lowered it, and it sort of voluntarily walked into my mouth.
Yo. I mean, that was a jaw-dropping scene.
I don't fuck with mouses.
I like animals. I don't.
Snakes. I don't like dead animals. There was a fucking dead rat right over there.
I wouldn't have put a dead mouse in my mouth.
No, that's...
But this was live, and it was... Was it one take?
Did you only do one?
Well, so then after we did it, I had to do it about 20 more times, yeah. And the mouse enjoyed it, really. It did every time. It was very relaxed in there, I could tell, because it urinated. So, you know, it was certainly not nervous.
Yo, that is fucking...
How much of that was improv? Like, not just that scene,
the
but
the urination?
That, just
or?
the whole movie.
Oh, the whole movie.
With all of your stuff.
Not too much. I wrote the song, the Tiny Salmon Swimming in the Stream song. I wrote that, like, on set right before we did it.
It feels like your whole performance was just, all of it was, it just felt like it was improv.
A lot of it was pretty scripted, though. A lot of it was, I was the tour guide.
Yeah.
I think the first couple of days, I didn't really realize how structured things were in films, because I was definitely improvising too much, and then, you know, Todd would be kind of like, okay, we kind of got to tell the story now, you know. But it was cool. It was a fun one for sure, yeah. But then I guess the one that really, this time was, you know, one of these surreal times that sort of probably once in a lifetime kind of things that happened where you got a hit show on MTV and all of a sudden people were asking me to do movies.
Right.
So I thought, wow, this is crazy. And we had this sort of attitude at the time where we wanted to kind of do things and make everything insane.
Right.
And the movies were not insane.
Right.
They were normal movies.
Right.
Normal comedy movies. Yeah. Funny, but not insane.
Right.
And so, you know, I sat down with my friend and we wrote this Freddy Got Fingered.
Right.
Because we wanted it to make something that was insane. And we did that. And I don't know. Sometimes I wonder, you know, what would have happened if I just did all the sort of normal funny movies that we were getting offered? Maybe I'd still be making a lot more movies.
Right.
But we have this huge cult following for Freddy Got Fingered that's pretty cool. And people love the movie. So I'm happy I did
Freddy
it.
Got Fingered and Road Trip. Like, those are fucking
iconic
classics.
Yeah, Freddy Got Fingered's a weird one, that's for sure. People like know the lines. When I do stand up now, I sometimes end my show with asking people to yell out their favorite line, and whether I'm going to Australia next month again or wherever I've been there a few times, and people know all the lines of that movie.
And they do them while you're doing your stand-up?
Becomes like this crazy, like, Rocky Horror Picture Show kind of thing.
Right. Everyone's just shouting them out.
Just everyone. At the end of the show, I get everyone to do it, and then I reenact the whole movie for people.
The whole thing.
Fuck. Yeah. I want to
be Are you enjoying doing stand-up?
I love it. Yeah, I love it. It's. I did stand-up before all that stuff. I did stand-up when I was... I did stand-up when I was, like, a teenager, before the public access show in Canada. And then started doing it again about 10 years ago and been basically touring nonstop. And it was the best decision I've ever made, I think, to go back and start doing that
because
again.
Because of what?
Because I have, like, first of all, I have this great audience all around the country and Canada and the U.S. and Australia and in England, and I can go do shows and make a living and do what I love to do, and nobody's really telling me what to do. So that's one nice aspect of it. I mean, the main thing though really is it's so cathartic,
right?
To be able to get up on stage, you know, 5 or 6 times a week for an hour.
Is that how long you do it?
Yeah. And I just kind of, like, can talk about whatever's pissing me off.
Uh-huh.
And hopefully try to make it funny, or make it funny, you know? And And I think the older you get, you know, I'm 44 years old now, so, like, there's a lot more stuff that's pissing me off now.
Right,
I was pretty pissed off before, but now it's just like, you know, it's nice to be able to get up and just rant about things that you just find ridiculous, you know?
What are some of your recent rants, things that pissed you off, like things that you've been zeroing in on?
Well, very recently, lately, I've been talking a little bit more about my personal life because it's sort of a mess. My personal life is a complete Well, you know, like I just recently another girlfriend and I just broke up. You know, before we broke up, I was with this other girl. I'll have another drink. Thank you very much. Yeah,
fresh water.
Good time for a drink. So you know, talking a bit about relationships. How ridiculous that gets, I was going out with this girl, she would like throw a glass of red wine in my face.
Holy shit.
Over public.
What?
Over whenever she was sort of angry about something, she would throw a glass of red wine in my face.
The wine or the glass and the wine?
No, just the wine.
Like what just spurred the wine. One of the times she threw glass in your
and water? It was a brilliant strategy, by the way, on her part. Like if you're in a disagreement with somebody and you're in public and you throw a glass of wine in their face and then run away.
You look like the fucking asshole.
Of course you look like the asshole.
You never win.
Everyone's looking at you like, oh, that guy's an asshole.
You must have done something.
You must have done something wrong. You're wet.
Right.
You're stained.
I mean, it looks like a murder scene with a fucking red wine all over your face.
It's like, and so this was starting to happen very regularly.
Are you fucking serious?
This is probably not going to work out here.
How many, like, after the first time, you weren't like that?
I thought, okay, maybe I did something wrong. Maybe I said something wrong.
Like, what do you remember what caused the first or second time? Or any of the times? I've never had that happen to me. And I'm a motherfucker.
And when she's ordering the red wine, I would have been like, you're not fucking ordering red wine.
Oh, no. I mean, it got bad. I was literally planning my evenings. I'd be wearing like burgundy sweatshirts and shit.
So it matches.
<Holy shit. laughs>
So you couldn't tell the difference? That's fucked up.
I talk about that. I talk a lot about technology in my stand-up. I talk a lot about, like, I've been talking about this for a few years now and expanding on it, just about how we're all addicted to our Facebook pages and our cell phones and our texting.
He is the fucking
worst.
We
can't stop texting. We're always on Twitter and and you go out with people now and everybody's on. I was at El Compadre a few weeks ago, and I was sitting there with my friend. And I looked around the room. There's maybe 15 other people in. It was at lunchtime. There's maybe the restaurant was half full. There was maybe 15, 20 people there. Every single person in the entire restaurant was texting, looking at their phone. It was silent. Nobody was talking. We were in a nice restaurant.
Right.
Nobody was talking. Everyone was just sitting there like robots on their phone, and that really annoys me. I being 44 years old. You know, you don't probably remember what the world was like before cell phones,
I
right?
actually do.
You probably, don't.
Yes, I do. I'm 25.
Yeah, you're 25. You claim to know what the world was like.
You know nothing.
Before.
I got a cell phone in ninth grade.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was a fucking
antenna.
In ninth
grade, what year was this?
Exactly. So that's exactly what
what year was this?
But honestly, that is exactly my point. In ninth grade, you had a cell phone. I didn't get a cell phone until I was 28. Okay,
but now it's like fucking 7 years old.
I went all the way through high school without a cell phone.
Me too.
You know, you would walk to school, you'd be alone, nobody could get a hold of you, it was more relaxed.
You'd be in your thoughts, your fears.
Your thoughts.
Your perversions, everything.
It was a relaxed world. You had freedom. You had freedom to go
horrible.
Do things. Now everybody always can talk to you. Whenever
so
you're anywhere, at any moment, some bad news could come in.
Ugh.
You're always on edge. You always know that at any moment, this thing in your pocket could deliver some bad news.
Or you might have a great stroke of brilliance that you have to tweet out.
Yeah.
Because I have strokes of brilliance.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it's like, I got to get them out.
Exactly. Before, you'd just think about it. Mm-hmm. You'd know it was great. And then you'd forget about it. And you would never tweet it out.
Yeah, it's
and
fucked
up. And it was nice. And it was magical.
So, that annoys you, but how often are you on your phone?
Oh, a lot. But I'm aware of it now. And I make an effort to
do you like leave it at home and then you go to lunch and you see it and then it's like a whole other world.
I don't leave it at home, but I turn it off a lot.
All right, that's good.
I don't check it a lot. I'm always very conscious of when I'm with people not to check my phone, unlike most people.
I like that, Michael.
Yeah.
Most
fucking
people
take
when
notes.
I'm with people, they're always on their phone, and I actually like feel sometimes like it's disrespectful, you know, when you're out with people to start He's like, hey, I thought we were having our time together.
It's bad.
I thought we were hanging out together. Who are you talking to now? Who are you talking to now? Why are you talking to somebody? I took time out of my day to hang out with you, and now you're talking to everybody else?
And then you got to repeat yourself. They didn't hear it.
Yeah.
No, it's like, I'm not saying it. I'm fucked up about it, too. Yeah. I'm all cracked out on my shit. Yeah. It's like an epidemic.
Yeah.
It's fucking, it's bad.
Yeah. And I have a lot of... Sort of scenarios that I paint my stand-up about relationships and how, like, Instagram and Facebook is just annoying when you're in a relationship. And I'll sort of dissect people's relationships and married couples in the front row of my show. Do a lot of crowd work with people.
Oh,
and
do
stuff.
You?
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, it's fun. It's
that's cool,
it's,
man.
It's really fun. I want people to leave the show thinking, like, okay, we laughed a lot. We had a good time. Everything he said was funny and true. But also maybe think, you know what? I'm actually going to, like, you know, turn my fucking phone off once in a while.
Right.
I'm going to go take a walk with my phone off.
I like that. You know? Are you going to be performing in L.A. anytime soon?
I will be, yeah. But I'm on the road the next couple months.
You're going to Australia?
Going to Australia in March.
Oh. For how long?
For 3 weeks. Oh, so
all over Australia?
All over Australia. I'll do a couple comedy festivals in Melbourne. And
I've never been to Australia, but I've heard the women are beautiful and just sort of open.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Is that real?
Yeah, it's like Canada with palm trees.
Canada's like that, too?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But are you going to be, like, is it every day, a show every day, or do you get some downtime to, like, chill out and
pretty much
fun?
A show every day, yeah. Right. I got a couple days off here and there. There's travel days because I got to go to different cities.
Right.
But, you know, it's just one show a day, so it's nice. You get the whole day off to hang out. Then you go do a show, and I play these nice theaters in Melbourne and Sydney where there's these big comedy festivals there. So I'll go do six nights in a row at a comedy festival in Melbourne. And
that's cool.
It's really nice theater.
And, like, how many seats are, like, these theaters?
They're about 1,000 seats, 800 seats.
That's
you know?
Nice.
Yeah, yeah.
Is there a specific place where it just doesn't translate to people? Like, have you experienced that where you're like, fuck, this is just...
Good
it's not
question,
working.
Dean. That's a good question.
Sometimes, no. The answer is no, but which was a surprise to me because I was sort of the first time I went there. I thought, geez, I hope they, you know, understand my accent or know what I'm talking about. But you'll notice the first night when you're there doing your first show that there'll be certain jokes that just will fall flat, and then you realize, they have no cultural reference towards what Sears is. You know, they don't know what the Sears catalog is. You know, or if you refer to, like, you know, whiteout, they go, you know, like you don't even know what whiteout is.
I know what whiteout is. Come on,
you've never used whiteout in your life.
What is whiteout?
Whiteout is fucking the white shit that you put over an error on your paper.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. When you had to do that.
Listen,
when you had to do that back before you were born.
You're 25.
They had this stuff called
whiteout. I'm almost 26.
So, anyways.
You're on a fucking ticking time bomb.
When Road Trip and Freddie Got Fingered came out.
What year did Road Trip come out?
2000.
So I was 10 years old, and I remember when that came out, and
10?
Me and my friends at camp, we were like, holy shit. I remember my friends at camp snuck a copy of Freddie Got Fingered in their bag, and we had a portable
like
DVD
a
player.
Porn, like a bad
It was
porn.
Like that. And we would watch it, and they, like, took it away from us. It was
confiscated,
like,
the
absolutely.
Illegal. Yeah.
so Tom, who are your guys? Like, because one of the what's the guy's name? Because I want to ask you about the Letterman, but Letterman's guy that was on there for years,
Chris Elliott.
Chris Elliott.
Love Chris Elliott. Yeah.
Because like you, that, I was just thinking, like, and obviously Andy Kaufman sort of was, you know, bridging that, like, what's going on? Is this real? Like, who are the people, like, you looked up to and admired? You know, that you know, sort of influenced that style that you had.
Well, Letterman was just the whole Letterman show was probably the biggest sort of influence, in the sense that, I mean, the whole show was modeled after that. You know, I mean, not as much, you know, our pranks and things were completely different, but he would go out in the street. When he would go out in the street and do stuff, when he'd yell out the window on his megaphone or deliver a fruit basket over to the, you know, the head of the GE or whatever, and getting arguments with security guards.
Right.
When he would get in arguments with his guests, all of that, like, TV gone wrong stuff was something that was hugely, you know, exciting to me. You know, when Late Night with David Letterman came on, that was, like, the first time I remember ever sort of seeing that.
Right.
You know, where it was like, you know, you'd been watching Johnny Carson with your parents your whole life, and now all of a sudden there was a guy that was at a desk, kind of like Johnny Carson, except he was fucking around,
right?
Like, he was, like, you know, doing stuff that sort of seemed like things were going wrong.
Right.
You know, Madonna called him an asshole. Yeah. Holy crap, someone said asshole on
right.
TV, you know?
Right.
It was, you know, Crispin Glover tried to
oh
kick him.
God.
And he came
that
back.
Was
and
nuts.
I'm not sure that Letterman liked that bit so much, but it was, to me, that was like, this was one of the great moments of the show, you know, when things would go wrong, you know?
Did you see the Andy Kaufman thing, live, or did...
You know, no, the Andy Kaufman stuff, I kind of found out about Andy Kaufman later, actually, which was, I don't know if it was just something that I mean, I knew him as from Taxi, but I really didn't know the whole
Man
mythology
on the Moon really put that out
until
there.
When Man on the Moon came out, which was bizarre because I was actually, you know, basically when that movie came out, I was in the hospital with cancer myself at the exact same time that Man on the Moon came out. And people were saying, hey, is this like an Andy Kaufman thing? You know, are you pretending to have cancer? All this guy. So,
yeah.
But yeah.
I'm pretending.
So, yeah. It was a lot of weird stuff there. But I love Andy Kaufman. Now that I've gone and watched everything that he did, and but it was like Letterman. It was Monty Python. It was SCTV, Saturday Night Live.
Okay.
A lot of the things that like that, and then you know skateboard videos.
Uh huh.
Skateboarding videos. And, you know, hip-hop music and independent music. You know, I was at a college radio show. I did a radio show on a college radio station, in you know, when I was a teenager.
Were you playing hip-hop?
Playing hip-hop, yeah.
Did you see, there's a documentary.
I saw your movie. I love your movie, yeah.
No, not mine.
Yeah, I love your movie, yeah.
Thank you. I was talking about these guys.
We've talked about it before, though.
Yeah, I know.
I love your movie, Tribe Called Quest.
But I wasn't
movie.
Talking
Amazing.
About that. There's a
Beats, Rhymes, and Life, right?
Thank you. But did you? There's a doc that you should check out.
My favorite album of all time, Low End Theory.
It's a good fucking album. Stretch and Bobbito, Music That Changed Lives, about the Stretch Armstrong, Bobbito Garcia show that they did out of Columbia University. You should peep it.
You're gonna
fucking love it.
Okay, cool.
And because their show was sort of on the cusp of everything that was going on in New York, and it was, you know, sort of a younger version of what they, not younger, it was just another version of what stuff that was going on in New York, and it was a breakthrough radio show, and they did it out of Columbia.
That's cool.
It gave me goosebumps watching it. Like, it brought back all the memories.
We were like really, really into rap music.
How are you getting it up there?
And see, the thing is, you know, we were goofy Canadian kids, right? And, you know, with our Canadian accents and our, you know, zero street credibility.
Right.
But we loved the music. And, you know, there was an indie record store up there that we'd go to and get, you know, vinyl and cassettes. And we'd get, like, you know, the old, you know, I mean, the first time I heard a rap song was Sugar Hill Gang, Rapper's Delight. I had it on a cassette. I had it on a compilation cassette and just listened to that over and over.
The Sugar Hill Gang compilation?
It was just like a top 40 compilation, but that one song was on it.
Of course.
It was the first time I'd ever heard anything like it. And I just listened to that song for a year, but they weren't playing that on the radio in Canada. There was none of that stuff. It wasn't until maybe really the first year of high school that, you know, like... There was other kids listening to, you know, Run DMC, Beastie Boys.
Right.
You know, it was really, that's when Public Enemy was when we knew, okay, this is really, you know, this is really like something different now when I started listening to Public Enemy. Because Run DMC was still playing on the radio.
Right.
You know, that was mainstream at that point.
Right.
But, you know, Walk This Way was mainstream. But
that was huge.
But then, you know... Nobody knew what, you know, nobody in my high school knew what Public Enemy was.
Uh-huh.
They weren't listening to Public Enemy.
Uh-huh.
You know? They weren't listening to Boogie Down Productions or Gangstar, you know?
Right.
And we sort of discovered this world and just really kind of got into it. I started making music. I started making beats. I got into, like, samplers.
Did you really?
Yeah, I got, like, Akai samplers and drum machines and keyboards and all this stuff, and really kind of got into trying to make music, and basically made started making music. And when I was 16 years old, we met this guy in Ottawa who was American guy from Atlanta.
Uh-huh.
He had his brother Boogie.
Okay.
In New York.
Was it Boogie or Boogie? Because you said Boogie Down Productions, and I think it's just your accent. Was it?
B-O-O-G-I-E.
Boogie.
So I say Boogie, you say...
I say it wrong. I say Canadian. Yeah.
No, I know.
I meant Boogie.
There you go.
I meant Boogie.
There you go.
Not Boogie.
No disrespect. Yeah. You know,
I even say Booger.
A booger.
Not booger.
But that sounds even
good. It's just a Canadian thing.
I got it.
I have no pasta, pasta, taco, taco. We got Clamato in Canada. We make Caesars. You make Bloody Marys with tomato juice. Right. You know, it's there's so many differences.
So Boogie from Atlanta.
Yeah, yeah. So he had a recording studio in New York. Mm. And when I was 16, he brought us to New York to record a demo.
Uh-huh.
So we got to New York, and we stayed at his place for, like, 5 weeks.
Oh, shit.
And recorded. And, you know, sometimes he'd leave for days at a time. We'd just be at his house, like, hanging out in New York City. 16 years old. I can't believe our parents let us go, but they let us go down there and do this. And he had a cousin who lived in Brooklyn and in Brownsville.
Oh, shit.
And we went to Brownsville and we shot a music video.
Get the fuck out of here.
When I was 16 years old.
Are you fucking serious?
Yeah. And I remember that it was...
Because Brownsville...
That's where Moody's tough, from,
that's
right?
That's where I grew up. My best friend, Brownsville,
tough part of the
New
York.
It doesn't get
York.
Tougher.
And it was... I remember that it was, you know, we were like these, you know, goofy, you know, white Canadian kids from Ottawa.
They must have been like, what the fuck?
And we rolled into Brownsville and we took out some speakers and we set up our speakers and we just started rapping the song.
Shit.
And everyone crowded around, came out of all the projects came out and started hanging with us and dancing. Everyone was dancing. It was totally amazing video, which I have on a VHS tape somewhere.
I want
to
see that.
Yo, you need to release that shit.
It's not on YouTube or anything.
Yo.
And I have to go find it.
We got to put that shit out.
Yeah, yeah.
We got to premiere it here. Somehow we need a visual element.
I got to.
It exists. It does exist in a cardboard box somewhere in a storage space over in Burbank somewhere.
So you could have taken. So why didn't you take the music path? Like, were you serious enough to be like, I want to do music?
So we got a record deal in 1990 in Canada,
and this is straight hip hop.
It was, you know, it was us trying to be like, you know, we were trying to do our version of the Beastie Boys,
right?
We just weren't, you know, as good as the Beastie Boys, right? But we wanted to be, though. We had the desire to be as good as the Beastie Boys, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I like making the beats, but you know, we had a single that came out in Canada in 1991, and we got nominated for an award in Canada, Juno Award, which is like a Grammy. And then we did one record, didn't sell enough records, got dropped from the record label. I went back to school and studied broadcasting and started the TV show.
The rest is hip-hop history.
Yeah. You should incorporate that. On your shows, whoever you were doing
with. I did the Bum Bum song on MTV.
Oh, that's right. Okay, so that's where a lot of the musical stuff.
I brought some
of
the music back, but that was a little bit sillier than what we were doing.
Right.
But the group, the rap group was always had its comedic elements, you know. It was like, we would like, I always tried to make it really weird. So we kind of got in a little conflict with the band when the band was coming out because, you know, we'd always been doing really weird shit on stage.
Right.
Like we'd do two songs and then some, you know, bad industrial music that I made would kick in and we'd all put laundry baskets on our heads and just like start rotating slowly for like 3 minutes in front of the audience.
During the show.
We opened for third base at I don't know if they even know this because they had this group called the Dream Warriors from Canada open for them. And we went down to Rutgers University.
Sorry to correct you.
New Brunswick, New Jersey.
So, go ahead.
We drove down there to open for third base. Never met third base, but I don't think they even know this happened, actually.
They would probably appreciate it.
Yeah, this was years before I was on MTV, and we were opening for their opening act.
Okay.
So their opening act was the Dream Warriors from Canada. And so we went down and did like three songs in front of their crowd. And
how'd that go over?
It went over pretty good. I think the laundry baskets confused them a little bit, though. The crowd was a little confused by the laundry basket moment,
which
was very enjoyable to me.
Right.
Because, you know, we'd be rapping. Everyone would be kind of like, oh, who are these kids from Canada? This is pretty cool. And then all of a sudden we break out the laundry baskets. And like you could tell like the audience... You know, this was a hip hop crowd, right? This was This was like 1990. This was maybe 91, something like that. This was a crowd that took their hip hop seriously.
Of course.
Rutgers University, New Jersey, and they were there to see third base, and then all of a sudden we got laundry baskets on our heads. But I don't think they were really quite able to like hate on it because it was just too fucking weird,
right?
You know? So I think it actually went over pretty well. It was pretty funny.
So. since you said you made beats, who would you say your top three hip hop producers, your favorite? Mm. And I know it's interchangeable, and if you want to do five, you could do that. You know, like the sounds that
producers, that, huh?
Producers.
Let's see. Well, Premier,
like, of course,
like his
Gangstar.
Yeah, absolutely.
And many, many others.
The Bomb Squad.
Okay.
Public Enemy.
Okay.
Just because it was so groundbreaking at the time.
Absolutely.
You know, those sounds, all those sounds that they had in there.
Yeah, they were doing it.
You just sort of couldn't really. Yeah, I remember when I heard Public Enemy for the first time, you know, you were sort of like, wow, what are all those sounds?
Yeah.
How are they doing that?
Yeah.
That was amazing. And I would say, actually, a friend of mine and I'm not just saying this because he's a friend of mine. He's probably a friend of mine because he was one of my favorite producers, is Mike Simpson from the Dust Brothers.
Oh, shit, okay.
Who did Paul's Boutique.
Okay.
Which I think is a groundbreaking, everybody considers that such a groundbreaking album for sampling and everything.
Yeah, I mean, they killed it.
So, yeah, those would be my three favorites, yeah.
And then MCs, who's your top five?
Top five.
You got to do top five. Top
I saw
five.
Chris Rock at the at a thing recently, and and it was that Saturday Night Live party that they had this year,
right.
The 40th party, and it was just a surreal. That was a surreal thing.
I'm sure.
But Chris Rock was there, and I walked up to him and I said, "I want to give you my top five."
Right.
Right. So I felt pretty cool about that. My top five. So here's my top five. I have a top five.
Give it to me.
In no particular order?
No particular order.
Okay. Well, Public Enemy.
Okay.
Beastie Boys.
Okay.
Eric B. and Rakim.
Yup. 30th anniversary of Eric B. for President the other day.
Yeah.
Fucked my head up.
God,
that
we're
song.
Old. We're so old.
That tripped me out because that song was like...
Yeah.
It's still such a unique, one-of-a-kind. The pace of it is slow.
Uh-huh.
And also, I mean, when it came out, but I was like, damn, man, 30 years ago that shit came out.
Yeah.
It's still, every time it comes on, I'm just like, God.
That was the first time I remember somebody rapping like that cool. You know, like they weren't like yelling.
No.
They were like laid back.
He just slowed the whole thing down.
That was a whole new sound. So, yeah, Eric B. Rakim, Public Enemy, Beastie Boys, Tribe Called Quest.
Okay.
And, this is the hard part because you want to pick the right one.
It's interchangeable. You know, you could be on the drive home. You could say, "Oh, it could be a different five."
Yeah,
I'm not going to judge you.
So I was never into the as much like I know a lot of people would say Tupac. I was never really into the West Coast style as much, even though I like Tupac. Biggie, I like Biggie, but that's sort of like a little more modern than maybe what I would say. You know, because I was sort of more into it back when I was
right.
Let's say Run DMC.
They're fucking
yeah.
We
Run
you
DMC.
Have a very similar list.
Yeah, I mean the list. Like, I mean,
because not only they were like they changed they almost created it in a lot of ways. You
yes,
know? They you know you got to kind of give them. I mean, and at the time, I was probably more excited about Run DMC. Than any of them because it was the first one that I really got into.
And they were so good and the style and the song making. They made great songs and the flow and then the whole presentation.
Yeah.
With the hats and the Adidas and the the shoeless shit and the leather jackets.
Yeah.
And then each one of them, Jam Master Jay being the center and then Run and DMC as MCs, they were just like it was just like a fucking super group.
Yeah.
You know, when you look back on like the talent level, it was like Run and DMC were both just boom, 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 and it just was. And then they brought it. They were just so influential, and they brought in The Rock and the Rick Rubin, and I mean, they just
everything for me is like goes back to when you first discovered something, how amazing it was to you, and the feeling that you got from music when you were first discovering things. So, I find it hard to like really get into like for me, I think I'm 44 years old, and I start saying things like. I used to hear my parents say, like, oh, the music's just not like it used to be.
But it isn't, though.
That's true.
But I think a lot of it has got to do with just when you first, like, when you're a teenager and you're discovering all of these things for the first time, not just music, like you're getting laid for the first time, you're drinking for the first time, you're partying for the first time, you're experiencing some freedom for the very first time, and you're discovering music for the first time, and you're really connecting with music on such a deeper level at that age because they're rapping about stuff or singing about stuff that's meaningful to you all these new things, girls, you know, partying, fun, you know.
Shooting people, killing motherfuckers.
Exactly, that stuff too.
Busting caps up in motherfuckers' asses.
Yeah. Yeah, and when you're, you know, then once...
Because I do that, and I did that. Like,
you get
I'm
that
like
out
spraying,
of your system.
I'm shooting motherfuckers left and right.
Right. Yeah, I would presume so.
No, I know. I know what you mean. I know, but what concerns me about hip-hop in general is that because of technology... Now anyone could rap, and you could put out songs so instantaneously, and you know, even like the diss records and all that shit. Like when Nas did Ether, like that was like, yo, this is life or death. When he took on Jay-Z, it was like life or death. When LL was going at Kool Moe Dee, it was life or death. You had, you know, there was no, I'm gonna put one out. Okay, this didn't work. I'll put another one out. You know, and it just was, you know, like when you had a record deal, like even for you, you had like a like it's like you had to do all this shit to get the record deal.
Yeah.
And then, you know, all this shit to do the single.
And going into recording studio cost a, you know, money, you know,
and that time
recording
was,
on 2-inch tape or
and
something.
And you had to go in there with your shit written and you like you couldn't fuck around. Mm-hmm. So I get concerned about the musicality and the craftsmanship. Like you talk about Premiere and we talk about Tribe and, you know, all the people, all the regular cast of characters, like it was a life and death quality to it. You know what I mean? Like
everything's like that now. Video editing, you know, like you got your laptop, the laptop computer now, or an iPhone, has all of these preset apps in them now.
It's crazy.
That basically automatically do what required a genius and an entire lifetimes of work and skill to do at the touch of a button.
It sucks.
You know, if you're a photographer, well, great. I must be nice to have spent like, you know, 10 years in photography school in 1980,
right.
And now there's a button that'll pick the filter.
It looks better than the shit you did.
Everything
and
is instant.
And there's pros and cons to it, but I just think with the music, it's like you can't, like, I don't know. So I don't want to, like, I know what you mean, because I have two kids. I got a 13 and 15 year old.
Yeah.
And I
people now, like, it, now it's about how people become experts at manipulating the latest technology, right? Like, and coming up with good songs. And I mean, I like Drake. I like when I hear Drake on the radio.
Yes,
I like that. I like that. I like when I was in Europe recently, and they had this music channel, and it was playing that Hotline Bling video all day.
Did you fucking jump out of a window?
Yeah, but I was sort of became the joke where I was singing it all the time to annoy people around me, which was funny. But I also think that it was catchy.
Yeah,
but
I do like Timmy Thomas.
Plus, you know, I'm Canadian, so I got to, like, you know,
hey,
it's nice to see a Canadian, you know, rapper crossover.
Especially a half black, half Jewish Canadian rapper.
Yeah, absolutely.
Who would have fucking thought that the biggest rapper in the world would be a Canadian half black bar mitzvah Jew.
Yeah, he was bar mitzvah, right?
Former Degrassi Junior High.
Yeah, you never
would have
thought it. I mean, I think it's only an America story by a Canadian.
Yeah, absolutely.
But you know, the thing about that song too, also, sometimes I wake up, I've never listened to the song all the way through. I swear to God, I'll wake up sometimes and I'll be singing that song to myself. And I've also done that with the Taylor Swift song. Players gonna hate.
I hate that.
I don't like that song.
Yeah,
what's
exactly.
happening?
Yeah,
that, I mean, those are good songs, though.
You,
I mean, like,
if you play anything enough times,
But I don't even listen to the song.
Good or bad?
Like, if I hear it in a car passing, that's how good Hotline Bling is. Is that you could hate it and it still gets into your soul?
Yeah.
Taylor Swift has the power to fucking get in your body and your cells without you even like against your own will.
Yes.
The Eminem thing.
Yeah, wait, hold on. I want to ask, because I was just going to ask.
Okay, now you said.
Please
the
don't.
One
no,
question,
no, no, just don't
hold
say
the
anything.
Fuck on.
Don't say anything.
Hold the fuck
Let
on.
Let me ask the question.
You've been preparing to ask the guy the question. Now get the fucking question out.
Why do you got to preface it like that? Like, why do you have to, like, shit on me?
Because
we're
almost at a fucking hour. I don't want to keep the guy, so just ask him
okay,
the question.
Okay, listen, shut up for a second.
Hit the fucking
going
question.
Going back to the Bum Bum song.
Yeah.
Back then. When Eminem
did
his own little parody
of the Bum Bum song,
in the Real Slim Shady, is that a conversation that you have with Eminem? Or obviously, he just throws it out. But what was your reaction to that?
I thought it was awesome. Yeah,
I mean, were you just like so flattered?
Yeah, I mean, it was sort of out of nowhere. No, it wasn't a conversation. Like, I didn't know that was happening until the video came out. And
how did
I heard
you
it
find
on the radio
out?
And I saw the video, and he was running around in my superhero suit. I don't know how he got it. It's the exact same one that was in the video. Or maybe it's not the exact same one. The exact same style of thing with the bum bum, the plastic bum bum. My lyrics.
Yep.
You know, my bum is on your lips. My bum is on your lips. I just want to go on TV and let loose, but I can't. But it's cool for Tom Green to hump a dead moose. My bum is on your lips. My bum is on your lips. Right. You hear that and you're like, what the fuck? That's cool. And the song's on the radio all day.
Right.
All day.
This is like biggest fucking hit.
And it's on MTV. He had also done a thing where he took over Total Request Live for a day, and he went out and he did impressions of me.
See, that was so prominently featured in that song.
He put a fake goatee on, and he was doing stuff with a megaphone. And
I remember.
Talking like me.
I mean,
yeah, it was cool. I've never met Eminem.
You never met him?
No.
I never met him either. I never seen him in real life.
Yeah, I'd like to meet him. But I did have when I made Freddy Got Fingered, I directed that movie, so I got to, like, do the soundtrack and everything. And so I put Slim Shady, that song, in the credit roll. Of course, you have to ask permission.
And pay.
He didn't give you a hookup for fucking you in there?
Well, he did give me a hookup. He let me use it, yeah. Because officially, they did not license music to anybody ever. They never gave any music to anyone. And they gave the music to us.
You know? Shout out to Eminem and Paul Rosenberg.
Yeah.
Are you going to direct another film?
I'd like to, I'd like to. It's sort of I mean, I don't know if or when I will, but...
Have you written anything?
I'm thinking I'm going to write a new movie soon. I have a few ideas. I just, I'm sort of, I get very, I spread myself in all direct. I'm touring doing stand-up. I'm always writing new stand-up. That's sort of the main thing. I'm actually going to start recording some goofy music again to incorporate into my stand-up show.
Oh, okay.
And then if I get a spare moment, I do kind of want to write another script, but I'm just going to... Got to find the time to do it. So,
fuck yeah, we're looking. I
do love directing, and like I love the editing process and the shooting and the writing process. But you know, it's just coming up with the right idea and figuring out what I want to invest. However many years of my life into getting it made. You know,
it's grueling.
Yeah.
How did you wind up guest hosting the Letterman show?
Uh-huh, yeah.
And since you spoke about loving him so much, like, how fucking tripped out were you?
Yeah.
I mean, that must have been, like,
that was surreal. Surreal.
And just so flattering to also sort of, you know, obviously he has approval over that, like, to get that sort of stamp of approval from. So how did it wind up happening?
That was probably the single most amazing thing, surreal, unbelievable thing that's happened to me, you know, through all of this stuff. Because, you know, it was unexpected, because he didn't even have people guest host.
Right.
Then all of a sudden, oh, I heard he was having some guest hosts. And then he stopped, and he didn't do it. And then out of nowhere, like a year after he'd had some guest hosts, I was in Los Angeles. I just got a call from, someone I work with who called and said, are you sitting down? I thought somebody had died. You know, I was like, okay, what's going on? You're hosting Letterman tomorrow. Drive to the airport right now. You've got a flight in 3 hours, you know?
So,
so drove to the airport. You know, I had to write my monologue, you know, on the plane. I had some, you know, friends of mine who were, you know, funny people who threw a few jokes at me, and you know, literally less than 24 hours later, I was walking out on stage at the Ed Sullivan Theater.
Holy shit!
And I didn't see Letterman that day, but he was actually there that day. It was on a Thursday where he did two shows, so he wasn't even sick. I don't even know why I got to do it, but I got a Letterman jacket.
Oh man!
So I got the Late Show jacket.
Who were your guests?
It was Scott Stevens from the New Jersey Devils.
Okay. That's always a great guest. You always want to, like, when you're doing guest, that's the dream. I want to host Letterman.
Yeah.
And then, but you're a hockey guy, though, right?
They had just beat the Ottawa Senators.
Okay.
And so I had this bit that I prepared with him where I pulled out an Ottawa Senators jersey, a New Jersey Devils jersey, gave it to him right there, and then I said, I want to show you how Canadians play hockey. And we go out into the performance area over by the band. I throw the puck down on the ground. I go, try to take this puck away from me. And then I do a bunch of stick handling, and then he just body checks me and knocks me across the room. So that was pretty cool.
God, that's funny.
And it was Jolene Blaylock, actress from Star Trek Babylon 5.
Okay.
Was the show.
Okay. Shout out to Jolene.
Yeah. Thank you, Jolene. It was a good interview. And there may have been a comedian or someone else on the show, but yeah.
Man, I mean, there's like no time to even process an experience like
that. It was, you know, you have those moments where, you know, you're kind of in this business where you just sort of, I'm sure you've had a million of them, you know, you're probably so used to it now, right?
But no.
When we're working with somebody, you're like, what the hell am I?
You never get used to it.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, as soon as you get used to it, or as soon as, you know, you start taking for granted something like that, you got to reevaluate.
Yeah.
You know, if you still love it.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, that's what you're doing it for. Like, you're doing it for those moments. You're doing it for that sort of, you know, when you reach that sort of, that in between, I call it for me, like, you know, in between action and cut.
Yeah.
You know, or like, you know, when you're on a set with someone you grew up loving, or you're hosting, you know, Letterman. I mean, like, you know, to be in front of Robert De Niro acting, like, I'm like, I'm in the moment, I'm focusing, but like after action and cut, I'm like, what the fuck? You know, I'm looking at him, I'm seeing the dimple, I'm like, what the fuck? You know, like, you're tripping out, you know?
Yeah.
But I think once you stop getting nervous and excited, then I think that's time to, like, hang up the cleats.
Yeah, that was definitely the most nervous and excited I've ever been, other than maybe the first time I was a guest on Letterman, which was, I was also very nervous, probably more nervous and excited that time, because he was actually there. I remember that time, that was only about a month after I'd been in on MTV, and that was the first show I ever did in America was Letterman.
The first talk show
I'd ever been on, first any sort of interview of any sort.
Shit.
He, like, saw the show and just for whatever reason just, like, responded to it right away. And I remember standing there backstage, and he was standing out there at his desk, and he looked over to the side of the stage, and I just was like, hey, I waved at him. You know, I waved at him. He waved back at me. I thought, oh my God, I thought I've made it now. I can go back to Ottawa and move out to the woods and quit at this point. Letterman just waved at me. Hadn't even done the interview yet. But then, you know, a couple years later, I got to guest host it, and I remember sitting backstage there, getting ready to go out, and, you know, they play the intro, and, you know they play the theme song, and Paul Schaefer was there that night, and he was playing the theme song. From the Ed Sullivan Theater, it's The Late Show. Tonight's guest host, you know, Tom Green. And I'm just sitting there going, what the fuck's going on? Biff is there.
Right.
You know, who is, like, actually the stage manager.
Right.
You know, he's got the headset on. He's not doing a bit that day.
Right.
He's just there being the stage manager. Right. You know, and I'm going, is this for real? I can't believe that. There's Biff. He's actually the stage manager. This is amazing. So
damn. That's fucking crazy, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's crazy. And then specifically, because I want to let you go, because we've been rocking for a minute.
Well, this is an awesome. Hour and Thanks 7 minutes. Thanks for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
Yo, man. Yeah. Yo, it's an honor, man. It's a pleasure.
I've got a podcast, too. We're network label mates.
Absolutely. We're label mates.
Yeah, CBS Radio, yep. Play It Network.
What's the name of your podcast?
The Tom Green Radio Show. And it's a podcast, but I call it the Tom Green Radio Show.
I want to come on there, man.
Yeah, absolutely. And I record it just down the street. So
you've always been sort of ahead of the curve, like, because, like, when I came to your house, I think it was 2007. And did you? I don't know if it was called, I'm sorry, the Tom Green Show, but it was out of your house.
Yeah,
like, you know, that you've always sort of been a beat ahead with that shit.
And you had the live stream, and back then I actually,
like, you were taking questions.
Yeah. I had
D, don't make it about yourself. I'll fucking kick you right the fuck out of here.
Saying,
finishing up the interview with Tom.
I'm making
Green.
It about all of us. It
no, but no, go finish up the thing.
No,
finish
I'm just saying I submitted a question.
He
and
submitted
you answered
when I came up to your house.
Yeah.
And I think it was about road
and
trip.
And you thought that was important enough to bring up now an hour.
I recorded it
in minute 9,
like, on my phone of you answering the question.
You really are his son, aren't you?
No, he's
I'm really not.
This
no
is a prank. You are
no,
his son.
No,
not at all.
We're a fucking prank. No, he's not. He's
no,
not.
No, I'm not.
Thank
God.
I don't care about the details of the relationship.
Okay.
But the one thing I have to ask you about, when you were doing Saturday Night Live during the fucking hysteria of Tom Green, and then the Drew Barrymore stuff, and then we're going to get married on TV.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to get married on TV. Can you reveal what was the real deal? Have you ever, like, what was that really going to happen? Was it not
going to
happen?
No, we were never going to get married on TV. No, we were never going to get married on TV. But we thought it would be funny to tell people that we were going to get married on TV and then have her leave me at the altar at the end. That was my idea. It was my idea.
And then the reaction to that and the sort of shitstorm that whole thing.
Well, you know, I think that was a surprise to me, that people take things far too seriously. I don't have a lot of regrets in life, but one regret I have was, and it's got nothing to do with Drew or that bit specifically, but the way that bit worked was, you know, I'm hosting Saturday Night Live. This is my opportunity to host Saturday Night Live.
Which has got to be up there in the surreal moments.
Yeah, it's you know, equal to it's you know, like I said, the Letterman was the most surreal thing. That was also the most surreal thing, right? Mm-hmm.
You're hosting, I would have tripped out live from New York.
Yeah, it was unbelievable. And you're sitting there going, this is actually happening right now. And for whatever reason, I decided with my friends when we're sitting around kind of thinking of funny things to do, what would be crazy? Let's have a moment where have a thing where we're going to say you're going to get married on the show, because we were engaged at the time. Let's get married and on the show, but then at the end she'll stand me up at the altar. And then when she stands me up at the altar, I'll freak out, go into one of my sort of screaming, hysterical sort of things that I would do back then, which this sort of, I don't know what that character was, but I don't really do that anymore, where I'd like sort of flip out. And then the entire cast of the show would uncomfortably walk away, and then I would be alone on the stage.
At the end,
band would stop playing, and I'd be all alone in silence. So this the classic ending of Saturday Night Live, where everybody's having this great, congratulatory, beautiful moment.
Oh, man.
Was ruined for me by this stupid idea, you know?
Right.
And I regret that because, you know, I love Saturday Night Live. I grew up watching it. It was, and I didn't really predict when we wrote that bit. We thought it would be funny, but I didn't really consider that that's going to sort of ruin the beauty of that moment with the band playing and the whole cast around and everybody smiling and waving and enjoying that music and cheering with the crowd. Instead, the show ended with complete silence.
Right.
Me alone on the stage screaming, Drew!
Right.
And then they yelled cut. It was silence. The audience was confused.
Because they don't know what's going
on. Did he really get stood up at the altar? Is he really freaking out? And I do kind of wish that we had just done a nice ending for Saturday Night Live.
Yeah. When that whole sort of wave of, you know, this couple of two celebrities and you're in it, because I've never actually, to be honest with you, I've never been in one of those.
Yeah.
You know, but I've seen it happen to friends, and
I haven't been in one since. So.
But when you're in the middle of that wave of, you know, paparazzi and, you know, fucking, you know, fodder and Esquire and gossip and all this stuff, like, are you like going, what the fuck is going on? Like, are you making fun of it? Are you scared? Are you questioning, like, is this sort of paparazzi and is all the what's the word, the gossip bringing us together? Is it pushing us apart? Like what was going on? Like, are you like freaking out during that? Is the relationship real?
Yes, it was. Yeah, I mean, I think the thing is my whole life was everything in my life I was goofing on at that point.
Right.
Even, you know, like, you know, Drew and I had a good relationship. We were obviously, it was real. We were engaged for real. We got married for real. Right. But you know, it didn't work out in the long run, but it was real at the time. And she's a funny person, and we would, you know, sort of have fun with a lot of that stuff.
So right.
With the, you know, there wasn't really like TMZ back then, but there was paparazzi and like people taking pictures and all the magazine articles and the tabloids and all that stuff. And I was probably naive to think that, you know, you could just sort of have fun with the media and expect them to understand that I was having fun with them and it's sort of a prank. I'm pranking you. You know, the media, like, actually doesn't like it when you make fun of them.
Right.
So I thought that they would kind of see it as, oh, he's doing sort of an Andy Kaufman type of thing.
Right.
You know, he's goofing on us. Okay.
Right.
No, people didn't like that too much. So, which, you know, hindsight's 20/20. But it was surreal and interesting time. But, it was a very surreal time. I mean, like, to encapsulate how surreal it was, the day after I hosted Saturday Night Live and did that prank, we got on a plane the next morning to London, England, and went and had dinner with Prince Charles at St. James Palace with about 12 other people for the royal premiere of Charlie's Angels.
Holy damn!
So, you know, you're sitting there going like, okay, I just hosted Saturday Night Live. You know, people are confused about me bailing on the marriage thing on the show. Now I'm eating dinner with Prince Charles at a table with 12 other people in St. James Palace.
Oh, that's crazy.
You know, now I'm sitting in a theater watching Charlie's Angels with Prince Charles. I'd play this character called the Chad in it, right?
So
That's how I met Drew. When she...
This is the first Charlie's Angels.
The first Charlie's Angels.
Yeah. I got a good story. Good.
When I was on MTV, they cast me to be the Chad, right?
Right.
So that's how I met her. We started dating. Now I'm in London having dinner with Prince Charles, watching the movie with Prince Charles. I have my line, you know, like I come out, I go, the Chad's great. You know, I do something. I fall off the boat into the water, right? And then Prince Charles like leans over across, you know, and taps me. Hey, did you really fall off the boat? were you really falling off the boat? And I'm sitting there going, what the fuck is going on
like,
here?
What's
man?
Happening?
Holy shit.
Not to top your Charlie's Angels story, and I didn't think about this. Yeah. I saw Charlie's Angels, the first Charlie's Angels, before it came out in theaters at Michael Jackson's house.
Oh, really? Wow. Nice.
And I'll give you the short version, but I was with Damon Dash, who started Rockefeller Records with Jay-Z.
Yeah, I've interviewed Damon before. I've met Damon a few times.
Yeah, I've grown up with Damon. Like, we've known each other since we were kids. But so Damon and Kadada Jones and a handful of Rockefeller people and this one and that one, Jay wasn't there. Damon was like, yo, you want to go to Michael Jackson's house? And I was like, fuck yeah. And he was like, come meet me and so-and-so. And in a few hours, we're going to go to Michael Jackson's house. So the short version is, you know, we get to Michael Jackson's house. This is before all the craziness. This is when he's alive and kicking.
Yeah.
It was, you know, like some of the craziness had happened, you know, like the child stuff and all that stuff. So when we get there, we saw the tree that he had done the interview where he said he likes to climb trees.
This was out at Neverland Ranch.
This is at Neverland Ranch. And, you know, like there before, like we get there like 11, they're like, you know, you could order whatever you want. And this is a bunch of New York hip hop dudes. And we're like, yo, I want to like try to see if that's true. So like some dudes are like, yo, let me get escargot. Some dudes are like, let me get clams with linguine. And all the shit comes for lunch. We're driving. We're having the whole fucking day at Michael Jackson's house. And then we go into the movie theater later on when the lights, you know, the night started falling. We go into the movie theater and we were in the movie theater where all the there was beds and shit.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Where, like, the sleepovers and all that stuff. And they serve us dinner, and we watched Charlie's Angels at Michael Jackson. He wasn't there. He was never there.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He was never there. But we had, like, run of the place. But there were servants. There was fucking security. At one, I mean, there was, like, a house on a hill. And I was like, what is that? I mean, far away. Like,
did you see the monkey and the were you on the roller coaster?
Shit.
Did you do any of the rides?
The whole fucking deal. A crocodile, a fucking giraffe. And the scope of it, if you try to, like, wrap your head around how big it was, like, you have to think Great Adventure. Like, if you've been to, like, Magic Mountain or Great, like, his property was that ginormous. And I remember kept saying to myself, like, take this in and try to remember, like, how big it was. But there was, like, a hill far, far away, and it was, like, that's where the security was. It was, like, I mean, it was, like, huge.
Yeah.
So that's when...
If he asked you to sleep over and he was there, would you have slept over?
Hell yeah.
You would have just been, like...
He ain't gonna
if
fucking...
He said, hey,
I'm not,
Mike,
just,
I want
I'm
you to
his
live
type.
With me.
I wasn't his type.
Too
I,
tall...
I just I'm no man's type,
right?
Anyway,
that's like, not true.
There's no gay gay man that's like thinks about like Michael Rapaport being like there's like they don't have like a poster.
None that you know.
Probably
of.
None of you either, Tom. Like I wouldn't think.
I don't know.
Maybe in prison they have. There's some of your headshots.
There's other people they would go to.
Yeah.
I don't know how we got that. Anyway,
okay, so that's forget about the sleepovers.
All right, Tom, I'm going to let you go.
Yeah.
This has been a pleasure.
It's so
been
much great. Fun. Awesome. Great to be here.
I would love to come on your show if you'll have me.
Yeah.
I'm a fan.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to have you on the show.
I'll come on.
Let's do it soon.
I'm looking forward to seeing what else you have in the future. Your health is good?
Health is good. Everything's good. I'm touring. I'm come see me on the road. Go to tomgreen.com and check out my tour dates and come see me on the road. Everything's great.